May it please the court, my name is Deborah Wagner, bar registration number 34428, and I'm the attorney for the appellant in this case, Ruth Kaler. Ms. Kaler is an 82-year-old woman whose only income is Social Security benefits. And despite some debilitating health problems, she's been able to live independently in the community with some supportive services. Medicaid has provided her not only basic health care, but also these supportive services through the Home and Community-Based Services Program. But in 2008, the department cut Ms. Kaler off Medicaid because she also received some of her husband's Social Security benefits after he went into a nursing home. The department said that Ms. Kaler could not receive both this cash benefit that she received as a community spouse and her Medicaid benefits.
She paid for the HCBS?
There was no cost to her for those services. No problem. Medicaid would have covered Ms. Kaler's care if she'd gone into a nursing home, but Ms. Kaler didn't want to do that. She wanted to continue to live independently in the community and not be forced into a nursing home. The court has asked counsel to address the rationale for State Rule 8.112.D. This state rule defines community spouse for the Medicaid long-term care program here in Colorado. Under the state rule, a Medicaid recipient cannot qualify as a community spouse and receive any of the cash income from their spouse who's in a nursing home. The department relied on this rule when it cut Ms. Kaler off of her Medicaid benefits because she was receiving that income from her spouse. I reviewed the rule documents and the medical board minutes from the adoption of this rule to see what they had to say about the rationale for it. They really didn't say much about the rationale for the rule, except to say that the rules were designed to conform with federal and state law. But the state rule does not conform with federal or state law. The definition of community spouse in this rule is more restrictive than either the federal or the state definition. The department exceeded its statutory authority when it redefined community spouse in this rule. And it violated Ms. Kaler's statutory rights when it cut her off her Medicaid using this rule, because she qualified for both Medicaid and for get the income as a community spouse under both federal and state law. The departments argued that under cooperative federalism that they had the right to redefine this rule, that they could do that. But that's not the case. The definition found in the federal statute is very clear. Congress set up a scheme whereby if you're on home and community-based services and you have a spouse who's in a nursing home, you're the community spouse. The rule's pretty clear on that. It was carefully designed, and when you read it through, it makes sense.
You say the rule, you mean the federal statutory definition?
Federal statute. That is okay. Correct, Your Honor. I apologize.
But the federal statutory definition permitted the states the option, right, to redefine institutionalized spouse to include somebody receiving what I call HCBS.
Right.
And Colorado's legislature exercised the option, right?
What it says is that they would be an institutionalized spouse as long as, the second part of that definition under the federal statute says, as long as they're not married to someone who's in a long-term care facility and a nursing facility. So Ms. Kaler did not meet that federal definition. Had she not been married to somebody in a nursing home, she could have qualified as an institutionalized spouse. But she was married to someone in a nursing home. So if you follow through the definition, she fails to meet the definition of institutionalized spouse. It's a two-part test.
As long as you read Roman 1 and Roman 2 in the disjunctive, if they're read in the conjunctive, which I think is how the ALJ read them, then he's right. But if he's wrong about reading them in the conjunctive, then you're correct. So she was not an institutionalized spouse because she wasn't married to somebody who was a community spouse.
That's correct.
Okay, that's your position.
That is.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. In addition, if you look to the state Medicaid manual, it offers some additional guidance, and it says specifically community spouses still qualify for Medicaid, and you have to look at the other rules. So they don't get the special protections of institutionalized spouses. You would count all of their income, all of their resources. They don't get these special protections. But when you looked at all of Ms. Kaler's income and all of her resources, she still qualified for Medicaid. As an SSI recipient, she was categorically eligible for Medicaid coverage. And if you look at the rules for home and community-based services, the fact that she received SSI made her eligible when she met the other prongs. She needed the nursing home level of care, and she met the financial requirements for the program. And she was elderly and disabled, so she clearly met the requirements.
Excuse me for interrupting. As I read the briefs, there was no reference to what other states may have done something similar to what Colorado has done here with this regulation, and if such a regulation has been tested in the courts anywhere. Have you found anything outside of Colorado that's analogous to what we're talking about here?
It's my understanding that the department has said that two other states have rules that are similar to theirs that restrict the definition of community spouse. I have found no challenge to those rules. But if you think that Colorado and two other states have this rule, 47 other states are following the federal definitions.
Are the two other states?
I researched those back when I started this case many moons ago, and I'm sorry, I don't have that information.
In any event, there's no litigation over any rules that those states have adopted.
I've not, and I've been keeping an eye out to see if there was any litigation in those states.
There was a situation here where Calder and her spouse could both have been deemed institutionalized while he was alive. Could both have been deemed institutionalized spouses, and clearly that wouldn't be a right to get cross spousal allowances?
Had they both chosen to go into a nursing home, and that was one of the options that we discussed with Ms. Kaler, she met the nursing home level of care, then those rules about a community spouse and all those protections, they don't apply because there's no one left in the community.
And if they were both at home getting HCBS under the Colorado modified definition of community spouse, would they then be eligible for cross spouse allowances?
Had they
both been at home, but both been HCBS recipient?
Under the federal definition, they could have both considered institutionalized spouses.
So they would be getting cross spouse allowances, one from each other, right?
In theory, but it wouldn't make much sense to do it that way. I think that when they did the math, that they would have a combined household, and so I don't know that they would consider them to be separated by institutionalization.
What I'm trying to get at is, I still don't know it. What was the rationale then for for the State Department adopting this modified definition of community spouse? I mean, why did they do it? I know you say the minutes don't tell, but what is the rationale? I'm going to ask them the same question in a few minutes, but.
My guess would be that it might have been a financial concern, that they were trying to save money by not allowing the community spouse to participate in the Medicaid program. But in the case of Ms. Kaler, that wouldn't make any financial sense because one of her options was to go into a nursing home, which would have ultimately cost the state more money than keeping her in her home with home and community-based services. I also think that there was maybe a lack of understanding about what the federal system was and how it was supposed to work. Some of these statutes and regulations can be complicated, and that's why I think that the state Medicaid manual offers some clarity for the states about how they're supposed to do it. And it says that they're supposed to follow then their normal rules to determine Medicaid eligibility for those family members who are still in the community.
I don't think it was done to avoid the cross spousal allowance situation that I just hypothesized.
It might have been done for that purpose. This is conjecture on my part. Yeah. I really don't know what the rationale was. In the research I did, there wasn't much information.
Well, isn't it enough that was one potential permissible purpose?
That may have been what they were trying to do, but that doesn't explain why they would then say that no one could receive Medicaid and be a community spouse. I understand when we're talking with somebody with home and community-based services, they might have qualified as an institutionalized spouse, but your average Medicaid recipient, somebody who's just on SSI and Medicaid, that there's no reason to be excluding them from this program.
My understanding of this case, and I'm hoping you'll straighten me out if I'm wrong, it seems to me that under the federal statute, the state has the option of broadening the definition of institutionalized spouse. And so the question really is in whether that option doesn't implicitly carry with it the power to broaden the definition of a community-based spouse or the person who's remaining.
Your Honor, I think that Congress actually very intentionally designed this. And under the definition of institutionalized spouse, they included HCBS recipients potentially. But then they specifically included the second part that said, unless they're married to somebody who's already in a nursing institution.
Right.
So I think that was Congress's attempt to address this cross-benefit situation.
But do you agree that is the issue? So we're basically down to these textual clues about whether that really is a permissible implied option or not.
Correct.
Okay.
And it was, the idea was if somebody qualifies for home and community-based services and they could go into a nursing home, then we could give them the special income and asset rules of an institutionalized spouse and keep them in their own home and save money for the state. And that's why they were given the option to consider them institutionalized spouses. But I think that when you look then at the second part of the definition, Ms. Kaler doesn't meet that requirement because she had a spouse in a nursing home. If there are no other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you very much.
You have a little less than 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Ashley Klein. My attorney registration number is 29362. I represent the Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing and appear from the Colorado Attorney General's Office. You have asked us here to discuss the rationale for the definition of community spouse in section 8.112. And the short answer is that that originates from federal law, which provides a choice to states. 42 USC 1396 R-5 gives two choices. Federal guidance from the administrative agency at State Medicaid Manual Section 3260 gives some additional information with respect to those choices. The Colorado Legislature enacted Section 2556-101 and elected one of those two choices. That legislative decision was implemented into Section 8.112D. But not only did the state agency implement it at 8.112D, it also implemented it through a federal waiver. Home and community-based services are a waiver program. What that is that's a contract with the federal administrative agency. The waiver itself has terms that must be submitted by the state and approved by the federal agency. So these terms were explicitly approved by virtue of being within that waiver program.
Say terms, what are you talking about?
I'm specifically referring, Your Honor, to the fact that Colorado elected the definition of institutionalized and community spouse in a more narrow way than the overly arching federal law. And let me unpack that for a second, because we talked about a minute ago, I heard discussion about whether it was an election that was big or small, and that there were two choices at the federal definition that we're talking about in 1396 R-5. But one of the things that makes this so confusing, I think, is the fact that 1396 R-5 is not a default. 1396 R-5 is an exception. And so we're talking about the size of an exception, essentially, because federal law essentially says if an individual is going to be determined eligible, the spouse of that individual, if there is one, that person's assets and income are also included in a computation for eligibility. For eligibility for Medicaid.
So you're talking about Mrs. Kohler now or her spouse?
I'm talking about the general program. Okay. I'm talking about generally the Medicaid program says when you have a married person who applies for Medicaid, their spouse's income will be considered as available to the applicant.
That's the point of the spouse allowance in the first place, is it not?
The spouse allowance, the spousal protection provision at 1396 R-5 is an exception to that. The question is, how big is the exception?
Congress has told us, though, haven't they? They said that the purpose is to avoid impoverishment of the community spouse who remains in the community.
That's right.
And you agree that's the purpose of it?
I agree that's the purpose.
Mrs. Kohler was a spouse who remained in the community, right? While her husband, for the time her husband was in the nursing home.
I think that there is some confusion. I think that the federal government allowed the state to choose how that is defined. There are two choices, and one choice says you can pick. We will exempt persons who are institutionalized in a nursing home or in another medical facility. That's choice number one. Or we exempt persons who are or we consider institutionalized persons who are in a nursing facility, medical institution, or receiving HCBS. The question, so we have categories of people who might apply for Medicaid. We have individuals. All of their assets and resources will be counted. We have couples where both people apply for benefits at some point or another. And we have couples where one person applies and one person does not. Ms. Coleman is arguing that MECA, the federal statute, should apply to both these couples. Couples where both people are recipients, or couples where only one person is applying. But MECA gives the state the option to choose. And in fact, Colorado has said MECA only applies in cases where one person is a recipient.
Where is that found?
It's the exception. It comes in the way that institutionalized spouse is defined.
On 25.56-101.
As chosen by the legislature.
And are you telling me that language is authorized, is one of the authorized choices that the federal government allowed the states to choose?
That's correct.
Okay, and so if we look at the federal statute, that language will be there as an available option.
It's not written exactly the same way in those words, but that is what the federal law has authorized, one of those two choices. So
you're talking about the words in subsection A of the federal statute in parentheses, which says at the option of the state. That's
at
what
the
you're
option
talking.
Of
okay,
the state.
I understand. And the state exercised this option, and it expanded, I would say it expanded the definition of institutionalized spouse to include not just a person in a nursing home, but also a person who's at home but receiving, for example, HCBS, right?
Fair enough.
Okay.
And I just want to carry that a little bit further, because based on something you said earlier, you said that when Colorado exercised or applied for this waiver, that the terms were approved by some federal agency.
That's correct.
Okay, I want to understand what that means. Is one of those terms that you're talking about the precise definition of institutionalized spouse in the Colorado statute and the precise definition of community spouse in the regulation? Were those approved, formally approved by some federal agency? Because I don't see that anywhere in the briefs.
Fair enough. The way that home and community-based services are optional, a state can choose to participate in a home and community-based services program. If it does, it must shape its program within some broad parameters. But one of the purposes of home and community-based services are to actually create efficiencies in delivery of services. And as a result, what the federal agency, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, does is they give states some latitude to make elections within those programs, and they will allow waiver of comparability in order to create and construct a program that meets federal goals with some choices made by the state. When the state does that, when the state elects to enter into home and community-based services waivers, it essentially files with CMS a document where it chooses different options. Subject to that document, they will submit it to CMS. CMS will review it with a fine-tooth comb. It will come back however many times CMS requires it to do so, in which the state agency will modify whatever terms CMS takes concern with. Once CMS is satisfied with the terms of that agreement, then it is approved. Subject to the approval, then the state drafts the rules that implement those provisions, and it submits those rules to CMS, and CMS reviews those. So,
what's the answer to the question?
The answer is the language is not necessarily specifically in the contract, but pursuant to the contract, it has been submitted to CMS, and if it was not consistent, CMS would have rejected it, and the state would have had to have rewritten the rule.
What's this record of CMS approving it? It's never mentioned in the brief or cited.
It's not in the brief, okay. Because at this, I think when the briefs were done, there was not an expectation, I think, that we were getting to this, we needed to hit on this issue. So,
as I understand your argument, the rules here are fully consistent then with the statutory definition.
That's correct.
Okay.
One of the things that is important to evaluate and perhaps unpack in this issue is the fact that Ms. Kaler's definition of institutionalized and community spouse is something that would be applied to everyone. In other words, the argument that they advance is that it is a binary decision. So you are either an institutionalized spouse or you are a community spouse. And in reality, that is not the case. You can be something other than an institutionalized spouse or a community spouse. Institutionalized and community spouses only fit in one category of persons under the Colorado definition that is consistent with the state, with the federal law. There is an entirely different situation where both individuals receive benefits. In that circumstance, there is no institutionalized spouse and there is no community spouse. It doesn't impact where you're living. It's more relevant to the analysis of whether you're a recipient. And so for a purpose, the way that Colorado has included HCBS within the definition of institutionalized, that means that regardless of where you live, if you take benefits, you are in fact considered not in that construct of institutionalized community if both members are taking.
Right. They're both institutionalized spouses, aren't they?
Well, then you don't have spousal protection. And here's why. The whole purpose of spousal protection is to allow one individual within the family unit, within the couple, to shelter assets from Medicaid. The practical implication of spousal protection is that the institutionalized spouse's income may, if the community spouse's income is low enough to not meet NMNA, then the institutionalized spouse's income will in fact help raise that up. It will shelter it away. Typically, the income of the institutionalized person goes toward their cost of care. Medicaid and Colorado have created and structured their program in accordance with this waiver on certain assumptions. Those assumptions are fiscal assumptions. They have identified that they expect to have so much money dedicated toward the cost of the care from the recipient. And in fact, if everyone is considered an institutionalized or a community spouse, then those assumptions don't match with the way that they've calculated the program.
Let me play off of that a little bit. If a state can make the kind of choices that you're saying Colorado made here, and know that it's consistent with federal law, why would any state not choose to do that? And because it's going to save them money. And if that's the case, why have 47 states not done that? I don't get it. If that's the result, why wouldn't every state just raise their hand and say, yep, I'm in. It's going to save me money.
Well, I'm not sure that 47 states have chosen that. I know that at lower levels of this appeal, there were at least two other states called out that have put together these rules, but I'm not sure that an exhaustive review of every state has been conducted. And the reality of it is different states have different funding. They have different ability to provide for their people. And that's the whole purpose of cooperative federalism. We leave it to the feds leave it to the local jurisdictions to make certain decisions and to meet the needs of the community that they're serving at the local level. And so it boils down more to what Colorado has decided is appropriate for its residents. And based on its fiscal outlook. I think that in closing, because I see my time is coming, drawing short, in closing, the one thing that I would like to remind the court is that Colorado bargained for this set of parameters. It created this agreement. If Ms. Kaler's argument is in fact adopted by this court, it will not only rewrite the contract that Colorado has with the federal agency, it will also have serious fiscal consequences. And that is something that is not necessarily contemplated just on the face of her argument. This is not just a question of Ms. Kaler. It's a question of how do we redefine the entire program with respect to the treatment of institutionalized spouses.
Can I just...
I think we're going to keep you up here a little longer.
Yeah, we're interested, so we're going to ask a few more questions. Would you agree with Ms. Wagner that as far as you know, there's no published cases or any litigation on this issue anywhere else in the country as of right now?
The only cases that I have found, we cited in our briefs, the Houghton case, I believe, and the Bloomer case. And neither one of those actually deal with the specific questions that the court has raised here. They deal with other aspects of MECA, but I have not found anything that talks specifically about the scope of the definitions.
Explain to us how the regulatory definition was, I'll just call it approved by CMS or reviewed by CMS. I don't think that's the right terminology, but I still don't understand the purpose of it. I still don't understand exactly what the rationale was. As I understand it, Ms. Kaler was eligible for a spousal allowance because her husband was in an institution and she was a community spouse, right? When she started receiving HCBS, and or maybe she was receiving it all the time, the regulation took away her well, you gave her an option, but basically it took away her spousal allowance because she was no longer defined as a community spouse. What purpose was served by adopting a regulation that modified the federal statutory definition and took benefits away from, I mean, took spousal allowance away from a still community-based spouse because she was receiving HCBS? And let me just clarify one thing. HCBS is not money, right? It's services.
That's correct.
She didn't get money for it. So HCBS benefits don't substitute for the spouse allowance, do they? That's not the rationale, is it?
No, Your Honor.
No, okay.
The...
So what's the rationale for taking away a spouse allowance from a person who still remains in the community because they're also receiving in-kind services that the state has approved?
In a nutshell, it allows, and I'll use a real basic term, it allows double dipping. And here's how. It allows...
Prevents double dipping.
I'm sorry?
Prevents double dipping, the regulation.
Regulation,
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted.
The regulation, as Colorado has created, mm-hmm. prevents double dipping. Right. And here's how. If Ms. Kaler, a woman in her position who has a spouse who is also receiving benefits, whose income is sheltered away from going toward the cost of his care, she's taking that protection while at the same time taking Medicaid benefits. And so the regulation is intended to prevent that. And it could have been created. Congress gave us the option to allow that. But
let me stop you there, though. What she's getting out of her husband's income is cash.
That's correct.
What she's getting from HCBS is services. So you're saying the double dipping consists of getting both services and cash, right? That's the problem?
At the base level, okay. Yes.
But she gets the cash as a community spouse, whether or not she's disabled. It has nothing to do with that, right? It's to take a little bit of her husband's income and transfer it over to her before, so she's not impoverished, right? She gets it if she's perfectly healthy, the spouse allowance, right?
Yes.
On top of that, if it turns out she's qualified to go into a nursing home but doesn't want to do it, she would qualify for HCBS, so she gets in-kind benefits, services, right? Why is that double dipping?
Because she's not always entitled to take her husband's income. Let's suggest if Mr. Cole, let's change the facts to kind of illustrate and highlight that. If Mr. Kaler is still in his home, receiving HCBS benefits, and she is too. She is not entitled to take some of his income.
Why not?
Because both members of the couple under the law cannot receive both. In other words, there are income and asset eligibility requirements for Medicaid. You have to spend down your assets. Medicaid is not a program for everyone. It is a program for the most needy. And we use that as a program of last resort.
So I understand if they're both getting HCBS and they're both at home, there's this problem. We double dipping or across the line. That's a problem.
That's right.
But that's not the case we had here because he wasn't at home.
That's right.
He was a truly institutionalized spouse. So why should that rationale apply to this case?
He was, because the rationale is when two members, when both members of the couple are in fact receiving benefits, Colorado has said we are entitled to hold them to the standards of eligibility that a regular person, an individual would have. And Colorado is entitled to do so under the program. The default is that spousal income is available to you, and the default is when one person applies, you would normally have to show that your spouse has spent down their assets and spent down their income so that your entire household gets out of it. MECA changed that, but it changed that for a varying group of people. And the federal government allowed it to be one of two options, either a big group of people or a smaller group of people. And the bottom line is Colorado has looked at that option and said, as a state, we have so many dollars to go around. We choose to require our individuals who are receiving benefits and married to someone who is receiving benefits to have spent down their income. Here's the other, I think there was a question to Ms. Wagner of what happens if she were to go into a nursing home, and so they're both institutionalized, then the cost of their care would be partially borne by them. There would be no spousal protection. Ms. Kayla wouldn't be allowed to claim a spousal protection. They would be restricted to $3,000 worth of resources at most.
We're both institutionalized. There is no community spouse in that situation.
Well, it would be no. There's no institutionalized spouse.
That's right.
Within the meaning of that.
Neither one is technically institutionalized.
I see.
It's not a binary choice. You aren't an institutionalized spouse or a community spouse or nothing else. There is one exception, and within that exception, you have the possibility of an institutionalized spouse and a community spouse. And then there are a number of other permutations where both people start to meet the definition of institutionalized spouse but don't. And as a result, because community spouse is the person married to an institutionalized spouse, if you don't have an institutionalized spouse, you can't have a community spouse.
One other question before we let you go here. These different permutations and different results, and I recognize it's not an issue that's argued in this appeal, does that create any kind of constitutional problem from an equal protection standpoint? I mean, there was no double dipping in Ms. Kaler's case here, but we've recognized that there could be, and that was at least the way you characterized it, one possibility. Does that create a constitutional problem of any kind?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because it would actually create a problem if you recognized it according to Ms. Kaler's definition, because if you were to allow Ms. Kaler to take the spousal impoverishment, to take her monthly income from Mr. Kaler and allow her to get benefits, she would be put in a much different position than two individuals who actually receive, who are institutionalized, because we take a patient payment that goes toward the cost of their care, and so as a result you would actually have some couples who would be contributing toward the cost of their care and others who wouldn't.
Thanks so much, Ms. Klein, for hanging in there with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ms. Wagner, you had about 5 minutes. Let's add another 5 minutes to your time if you want to use it, because we kept Ms. Klein up there for a little while longer.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. I want to address a few of the issues that have been raised. And the first thing I want to point out is that in the discussion of the Center of Medicaid and Medicare Services approving this waiver, that one of the things that was said is that they had to review it to make sure that it met federal goals. And I heard the federal goal of MECA is being this whole preventing the impoverishment of the community spouse. And that's really what this is about. And this is why the federal scheme was created the way it was. And that's why what the state is doing is violating that. Because the reality is that Ms. Kaler had some choices. And I sat down with her in the beginning and we talked about them. One, she could have divorced her husband of over 50 years to keep her Medicaid. She didn't want to do that. Two, she could have gone into a nursing home and spent her time, rest of her life there. She didn't want to do that. That doesn't make any fiscal sense for the state, for somebody who can live in the community to go to a nursing home when they don't want to. Or she could figure out a way to make it work. And the weird thing about this case is because Mr. Kaler died shortly after we started all of this, she was able to get back on her home and community-based services. The only way she made it during that interim was her kids were pitching in and helping her out with costs. If that hadn't been the case, and if Mr. Kaler had not passed away, she was faced with those two choices to be able to continue to support herself and get the medical care she needs. Divorce her husband of over 50 years or go into a nursing home. And I don't think that the state of Colorado really wants to be condemning people to nursing homes or forcing them to divorce their spouses to get the basic care that they need. And looking at the whole binary system that we were talking about, the binary system only exists when you've got one spouse who's in an institution and one spouse who's in the community, okay? And Congress very intentionally designed the statute to say that if you are getting HCBS services, you can be the institutionalized spouse. You can get these extra protections of the income if you're not married to somebody who is in an institution. If you're married to somebody who's in an institution, then you are the community spouse. So I think that this case is kind of challenging to think it through, but if you looked at the brief, I said very clearly, Ms. Kaler qualified for Medicaid as an SSI recipient. She qualified for HCBS when you counted all of the marital assets, all of the marital income. There was no dipping. We weren't asking for the special asset and income protections for both spouses. We were asking for them for Mr. Kaler, and that allowed Ms. Kaler to get a spousal protection allowance. And then for Ms. Kaler, we were saying, count everything. Count all the marital income she's getting. Count all the marital assets that she has. She still qualifies for Medicaid. So this was not a system where there was any kind of double dipping. I wasn't saying protect income and resources for both of them. We're saying protect them from the one who isn't an institution, and then look under the regular Medicaid rules for an individual, count all those assets, count all that income. Ms. Kaler still qualified for Medicaid.
Say about this argument they make that I'm not sure I really grasp, but CMS approved of the change to the definition of community spouse.
CMS does approve waiver applications. I've asked repeatedly for anything that specifically addresses whether or not they approved this definition, and I have been provided with nothing. I've been asking the department since we had the administrative hearing for specific information from CMS as a part of that waiver review process that showed that they approved this definition specifically.
When I came here today, I thought we would be focusing on the legitimacy of the definition that focuses on the definition of community spouse, the regulation that defines that.
Yes.
But I'm coming to understand that really we need to look at the statute that defines institutionalized spouse.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the starting point, because if you don't have an institutionalized spouse, you can't have a community spouse.
So we could scratch all these regulations on the one hand and still honor the definition, the statutory definition, and Ms. Kaler would be in the same exact place.
You're saying the state statutory definition?
The state statutory definition.
The state statutory definition is confusing because it says that an institutionalized spouse is someone who's getting PACE but not married to someone getting PACE, or someone in HCBS not getting. And so when I went through it and analyzed it, it looked like under the state statutory definitions, she qualified as both an institutionalized spouse and a community spouse. And I don't think that was ever the intent of the federal regulations or the federal statute. I want to point out that there is a state statute that...
Wait a second.
Yeah.
Roman II, the state option, as I tend to call it, says an institutionalized spouse is a person who gets HCBS, right? But they have to be married to a person who is not enrolled in getting HCBS, and her husband was not getting HCBS. Therefore, she was not an institutionalized spouse under Roman II of this definition. Isn't that right?
Looking at it.
Okay. Question, I guess, is whether he was an institutionalized spouse under this definition.
And wasn't he an institutionalized spouse under Roman I? Because he was an individual in an institution, and he was married to a spouse, not an institution. Right. In other words, just like the federal definitions read. So at all times, he was an institutionalized spouse.
Correct.
Unless you go with what the ALJ said, which is under Roman II, is the ALJ, or I guess it's the ALJ, read those as conjunctive, right? That both had to be satisfied, but it seems like to me like they're disjunctive. It's one or the other. I don't know what the position of the department is on that.
Yeah, but the state statute does not exactly parallel the federal statute.
No, that's the point. They exercise the option. But it seems like the husband was an institutionalized spouse under one. He was not an institutionalized spouse under two.
Right.
Or she was not an institutionalized spouse under two. She was a community spouse under 1A.
That is correct.
Because she was a spouse of a person who was in an institution. And arguably, he could have been a community spouse under 1A because he was a spouse of a person who is receiving HCBS. But he's obviously not a community spouse because he's in an institution. Under the federal law, he doesn't qualify.
That's
as a community spouse. Okay. Sure, I answer.
I understand much more, but I don't
know. Oh, that's good. Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Maybe you could pick up your line of thought.
That's fine. I just wanted to point out that there is a state statute that's generally known as the reconciliation statute. And it says that if there's some part of the state rules or the state statutes that we find are inconsistent with the federal statute, such that it would prevent them from being able to continue to get Medicaid funding for that program, that they can default to the federal system. So there is a pretty easy fix there. And if you'd like, I can give you the site. I know the department cited it in their brief, but it's 25.5-4-105.
That one more time.
25.5-4-105. And basically, it recognizes that these are kind of complex issues, and there are going to be times where the state doesn't get it exactly right. And rather than having the state lose its federal Medicaid funding because of that, if there's a problem with the rules as the state's written them, they default to what the federal government has so that they can continue to get that federal funding.
Houghton. While the states makes substantial changes to the definitions, to the eligibility requirements, and so forth, seem to give them a lot of latitude. Do those cases dictate a result here that the state, that the department's arguing?
There is some latitude for the state, but I think if you look at the cases, it's pretty clear that they've got latitude where Congress has been ambiguous or has not addressed an issue. And this isn't a case like that. Congress clearly defined their terms and set forth this scheme. And the intent of Congress is undisputed, that this is to prevent spousal impoverishment. So what the state's doing is creating a system that's going against both the stated definition and against the intent of Congress. You're looking at people who, like I said, Ms. Kaler had a choice, divorce her husband or go into a nursing home. She couldn't have both the subsistence income and the Medicaid.
I think the department, if they had more time, would get up there and say, no. The Congress gave us a latitude here, or they created an ambiguity because they put in that phrase at the option of the state in subparagraph A of the definition of institutionalized spouse. And that they would say, they said in their brief, that created an ambiguity in the definition of institutionalized spouse. I think it's the one that we just pointed out when they exercised the option where the ambiguity came in. Does that regulation address that ambiguity, and is therefore, is it valid on that basis?
I think this redefinition of community spouse that happened in the state rule goes far beyond what the federal government was allowing. In that definition of institutionalized spouse, it was saying if you want to include HCBS recipients and give them these extra protections and do something more for them, you can do that as long as they're not married to somebody in an institutionalized, who's institutionalized in a nursing home. So that's what they said. So it didn't really, in this case, Ms. Kaler wasn't an institutionalized spouse under the federal definition. She didn't get those special protections, but even without them, she still qualified for Medicaid.
Thank you, Ms. Wagner. Your time is up. Thank you to both counsel for coming in today and being patient with us with our questions. It's a very complicated case, and we appreciate your taking the time to come in on a Friday for oral argument. Case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.